So Richard Dawkins, interestingly, he defines biology as the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, he thinks that appearance is misleading, but he admits that this is the prima facie on the face of it appearance of reality. And think back to what we said earlier about the principle of credulity and the kind of argument that you can make there. Scientific discoveries beginning in the 1950s revealed the complex information processing systems and highly intricate molecular machines within cells, thereby reviving discussions about design in biology that had seemed to be largely within culture and dampened down by 19th century theories of evolution and their successors. Now, I think it's important here to keep in mind the distinction between the doctrine of creation and different models of creation that Christians hold, because they have different interpretations of scripture and of the relevant scientific evidence, and of course of how you should or should not put those two things together. So just for example, a good place to start on that discussion would be a book like Four Views on Creation, Evolution, and Intelligent Design, here in the Counterpoints series of books published by Zondervan. American Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga frames the issue like this. Starting from the doctrine of creation, we Christians recognize that there are many ways in which God could have created the living things he has in fact created. How, in fact, did he do it? Did it all happen just by ways of the working of the laws of physics? Or was there further divine activity? Well, we must look at the evidence and consider the probabilities as best we can. Well, what we might call the grand evolutionary story in our culture, or Darwinism, is not merely a scientific theory, one purporting to explain the origins and diversification of life on Earth over millions of years due to natural processes. Rather, it is really the naturalistic creation myth of Western culture. And I'm not using myth in the pejorative modern colloquial sense of an untrue story here, but rather a story that kind of encapsulates a worldview that tells you about the kind of reality you're living in. As Philip Johnson observed, Darwinism is the answer to a specific question that grows out of philosophical naturalism. How must creation have occurred if we assume that God had nothing to do with it? Nothing to add to the process. We talked earlier about the Kalam argument and the fine-tuning argument, and you could grant all of that and then still say, and then evolution happened according to those laws of nature that God had designed, acting on the initial conditions that God had created, and then tell a story about life on Earth. But naturalism, of course, just by the essence of its worldview, of its description of reality, has to ask the question, how must creation have occurred? Because we do assume that God had nothing to do with it, you see. Geneticist Richard Lewontin put it like this. He said, it's not that the methods of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our adherence to material cause to create a set of concepts that produce material explanations. No matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying, Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. This is coming very much from the worldview philosophy level here. Indeed, evolution is a term that means all sorts of things to all sorts of people and in different contexts. So, as philosophers like to say, it depends what you mean by. Evolution means many things. Here's kind of the grand evolutionary story of our culture. It includes a number of points: the ancient Earth hypothesis, the progress thesis, common ancestry, the universal common ancestry hypothesis, the neo-Darwinism, that is blind watchmaker hypothesis, and the naturalistic origins hypothesis. Ancient Earth hypothesis says that the Earth is about 4.54 billion years old. The progress thesis says that living things gradually increased in complexity over time, such that the history of life shows a general progression from the simplest type of prokaryotic single-celled organism to birds and mammals. The common ancestry hypothesis says that contemporary organisms are all descended from simpler ancestral organisms. The universal common ancestry hypothesis says that all living things descended from one original primordial organism. The neo-Darwinian or blind watchmaker hypothesis says that evolution happens through natural processes requiring no non-material or purposeful guidance. This philosophical idea motivates the scientific theory that mutation and selection, and perhaps other similarly undirected mechanisms, are able to explain the appearance of design in biology. Now, the neo-Darwinian so-called modern evolutionary synthesis combines Darwin's theory of adaptation by natural selection with the science of genetics. There is a more recent discussion between adherents of the modern evolutionary synthesis and of a so-called extended evolutionary synthesis, who advocate additional explanations of evolution, but ones that are still framed in terms of an unguided, unplanned process of physical chance and or necessity. So what you can think of as that Dawkins phrase, blind watchmaker, Darwinism at the philosophical level, remains the cornerstone of modern evolutionary theory, but there is this current heated debate about whether the modern synthesis of Darwin's idea plus genetics, evolution through adaptation, genetic mutation and natural selection, is a sufficient explanation of the data, or you need other additional explanations, importantly. But they all tend to file under this idea of Darwinism, of it's an unplanned material process that's happening here. The naturalistic origins hypothesis says that life arose in the first place from non-life, from non-living things, by an unplanned and unguided physical process. Now, I happen to have described these hypotheses in what I personally consider, roughly speaking, a descending order of plausibility. From most probable to least probable. To quote Alvin Plantinga again, he says, there is excellent evidence for an ancient Earth. There's less evidence, but still good evidence, in the fossil record for the progress thesis, the claim that there were bacteria before fish, fish before reptiles, reptiles before mammals, and mice before men. The naturalistic origins thesis, he says, seems to me to be, for the most part, mere arrogant bluster. Given our present state of knowledge, I believe it vastly less probable on our present evidence than is its denial. So that's his assessment of the range of probabilities there, roughly speaking, in line with my own. Christopher L. Rees, from the book Three Views on Christianity and Science, says we must be cautious about equating our interpretations of Scripture with Scripture itself, and our interpretations of nature with nature as it truly is. Thus, when we encounter apparent contradictions between the two, we should strive to ensure we are understanding and interpreting each accurately. In some cases, we may need to revisit our understanding of Scripture. And in other cases, we may need to verify that we are grasping the facts about the natural world accurately and interpreting those facts properly. And I would add, particularly not interpreting those facts on the basis of bad philosophies of science that we talked about yesterday. So philosophers Michael Murray and Michael Ray put it this way: for the religious believer, the conflicts between science and religion will involve balancing evidence against evidence. This is not a faith versus reason kind of caricature, right? This is balancing evidence against evidence. The empirical evidence favoring scientific claims against the revelatory evidence favoring theological claims. The Christian critic of evolution might, for example, conclude that the evidence for an ancient earth seems quite strong, while the evidence for the naturalistic origin of life is, in fact, virtually non-existent. This then needs to be balanced against the evidence of revelation. How clear is it that the Bible teaches that the earth is young, or that God directly intervened in the cosmos to bring about life? That debate, you know, is there to be had. I would simply say there is room for doubting our models of creation. As philosopher J.P. Moreland says, there are sufficient problems in interpreting Genesis 1 and 2 to warrant caution in dogmatically holding that only one understanding is allowable by the text. I think that is, you know, just painfully obvious on the basis that equally apparently sincere and informed Christians who know about sciences and philosophies and so on hold different interpretations of the text. So it can't be an obvious, straightforward matter, or we'd all agree. It's a bit like that at the beginning of the Bible, and it's very much like that at the end of Revelation and interpretations of Revelation as well, right? There are things that we hold doctrinally in common that we can all agree on, and there's lots of difference in details of interpretation. But there is also room, I would want to emphasize, for doubting Darwinism. The grand evolutionary story contains philosophical commitments that seem to derive from a naturalistic worldview. And these philosophical commitments can be replaced with other philosophical commitments, interpreting the same scientific data within a different worldview. For example, a theist might say that life arose from non-life by a guided physical process. It's open to them to say that, at the very least. It is possible to interpret the evolutionary story philosophically and the biblical story theologically so that they contradict each other. And it is possible to use this contradiction to argue against either the truth of evolution or the infallibility of Scripture. But it's also possible to interpret the evolutionary story philosophically and the biblical story theologically in ways that make them compatible. And one can accept and reject evolution in different senses, once we've distinguished these different claims from each other. For example, Charles Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection was only the points highlighted in orange. That's what Darwin put forward, the points in orange. Not the bits remaining in white. He didn't have anything to say about naturalistic origins. He speculated about it in a letter to a friend. But you know, maybe that would be possible to think about. But it wasn't part of the evolutionary theory he was putting. He was putting forward a theory about the diversification of life, given that you've got life. He didn't say anything about universal common ancestry. He talked about this view of life with, you know, life breathed into one form or many at the beginning by the Creator and then diversifying according to the laws of nature. It's possible to doubt some elements of the grand evolutionary story without doubting every element. So if someone asks me, do you believe in evolution? Depends what you mean by. Some bits yes, some bits no. Such doubts can be rationally motivated by theological, philosophical, and or scientific reasons. For example, some atheists deny the idea of universal common ancestry whilst still accepting common ancestry on scientific grounds. Again, some atheists deny the sufficiency of the modern evolutionary synthesis on scientific grounds, part of the extended synthesis bunch, but without denying the blind watchmaker thesis of there's no intentionality at operation here. So here's a quote from atheist philosopher Jerry Fodor. He said, phylogeny, that is common descent, could be true even if the adaptationism of Darwin's theory isn't. The classical Darwinist account of evolution as primarily driven by natural selection is in trouble on both conceptual and empirical grounds. An appreciable number of perfectly reasonable biologists, footnote, not, you know, Bible-believing Christian scientists, those religious nutters, end footnote, you know. Perfectly reasonable biologists are coming to think that the theory of natural selection can no longer be taken for granted. Or Thomas Nagel, in a book that I mentioned yesterday, Mind and Cosmos, he argues that the dominant scientific consensus faces problems of probability that I believe are not taken seriously enough, both with respect to the evolution of life forms through accidental mutation and natural selection, and with respect to the formation from dead matter of physical systems capable of such evolution. The more we learn about the intricacy of the genetic code and its control of the chemical processes of life, the harder those problems seem. Stephen Mayer says that the theory of intelligent design holds that there are telltale features of living systems and the universe that are best explained by an intelligent cause. So it's a very minimal claim, compatible with all sorts of different worldviews, but not with a naturalistic, materialistic worldview. The theory does not challenge the idea of evolution defined as change over time, or necessarily even common ancestry, but it does dispute Darwin's idea that the cause of biological change over time is wholly blind and undirected. So it's questioning that Darwinism bit of the grand evolutionary story. Indeed, I've argued in papers that I've published that there are three core claims of intelligent design theory. One, that we have empirical evidence that passes two reliable design detection criteria. Three, to warrant a scientific inference to intelligent design as the best explanation of the evidence. And the first two are more important than the third, which is claiming that that inference to design is a scientific thing to do. But, you know, if it turns out that it's a philosophical thing to do, I don't really mind. The real question is it a warranted thing to do? Is it true? Right? Is it a scientific inference? Well, many atheists like Richard Dawkins, Bradley Monton, Thomas Nagel, Victor Stenger will accept that ID is a scientific theory. They just think it's a false one. But they say, yeah, it's science, it's just bad science. And as Thomas Nagel says, a purely semantic, you know, how we define stuff again, semantic classification of a hypothesis or its denial as belonging or not to science is of limited interest to someone who wants to know whether the hypothesis is true or false. Because once you've accepted that claims can be true or false, whether or not they're scientific, that there's more to rationally warranted true or false claims about reality than science isn't the whole picture, then you can say, okay, well, it's not science, but it's good philosophy, and it's true. So I would actually argue that if it turned out that intelligent design was a true explanation, I'd just say, well, it's really implausible not to just call it science. I mean, what are you going to do? Transfer loads of funding from the science department down the corridor, across the campus, to the philosophy department to better understand how the physical world actually came about? That just seems really implausible. You're going to keep the funding with the people with the microscopes and the knowledge how to use it and just call it, yeah, they're doing science, right? So what about the second claim here, that we do have reliable design detection criteria? Well, we've already touched on one way of doing this, just to refresh your memory, from Bill Craig here, noting that as a basis for a positive design inference, in addition to high improbability, there also needs to be conformity to an independently given pattern. When we have that, that gives us this idea of specified complexity, which tips us off to design, and he gives that poker game example of all the hands in poker being equally and highly improbable. But if every time a certain player is in charge of dealing the cards, they always end up with all four aces, and that keeps happening, you know, it becomes really implausible not to suspect them of cheating. And they can't allay your doubts by saying, why are you accusing me of cheating? After all, any hand of cards that you're dealt is equally and highly improbable. I'm just really, really lucky in always getting the cards that are specified by this rule of the game that we're all playing happens to let me keep winning. If you want to go into the mathematics and the philosophy of this more, you need to delve into books by the American philosopher and mathematician Bill Dembski, like his book The Design Inference, which he's coming out with a second edition of soon, I hear, which is very interesting. Or the co-authored book, Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics. Now, here's Dawkins on specified complexity. He says, you and I are machines of complexity of a magnitude to challenge credulity. But I appreciate the fact that he's going to delve deeper into defining what he means by complexity here and say he doesn't just mean unlikely. He says complexity here means statistical improbability in a non-random direction, the direction of seeming designed for a purpose. So he's saying, I'm not just talking about unlikeliness here. I think what he's really talking about is specified complexity is a plausible indicator of design. Indeed, in an op-ed in Free Inquiry magazine some years ago, he said this: specified complexity takes care of the sensible point that, in the unique disposition of its parts, a pile of detached watch parts tossed around in a box is as improbable as a fully functioning, what he calls genuinely complicated watch. I mean, any arrangement of those watch parts is one possible arrangement of those watch parts out of all of the possible arrangements of those watch parts in the box, right? But there is something significant about looking into the box and finding a watch, compared to looking into the box and finding a pile of watch bits. And this is captured by this notion of specified complexity. He says, what is specified about a watch is that it is improbable, yes, but in the specific direction of telling the time. It achieves this function, this functionally independently given target. So we seem to have reliable detection criteria, and that seems to be accepted even by Richard Dawkins, for example. Well, do we have empirical evidence in the biological realm that will pass that kind of test? Again, Dawkins, he says, at the bottom of my garden is a large willow tree, and it's pumping downy seeds into the air containing DNA, whose coded characters spell out specific instructions for building willow trees. It's raining instructions out there. It's raining programs. This is not a metaphor, it's the plain truth. Life requires information and a specific, significant sense of that term. In 1953, Francis Crick and James Watson announced their discovery of the three-dimensional double helical spiral structure of the DNA. In 1958, Crick theorized that the sequence specificity of amino acids in the proteins derived from a prior specificity of arrangement in the nucleotide bases of the DNA molecule, which functioned just like alphabetic letters in an English text or binary digits in software or a machine code. Experiments in the 1960s established that the sequential arrangement of amino acids that determine the folding and thus the function of proteins is indeed encoded within the rungs of the twisting DNA ladder. Since the 1960s, therefore, it's been apparent that, as Origin of Life researcher Bernd Ulf Cupers observed, the problem of the origin of life is clearly basically equivalent to the problem of the origin of information. As William Collier points out, by the mid-1960s, the Hungarian-British scientist and philosopher Michael Polanyi realized that this information was independent of the DNA strand, and that, in fact, it had to be independent. The DNA code could be recorded on paper, magnetic tape, computer hard drives, or books, like any other kind of specified information. This information was extrinsic and independent of the medium that carried it, and completely unexplainable by any known chemical or physical phenomena, implying that the living cell could never be reduced or explained by natural laws. Starting with Polanyi's landmark 1967 paper, Life Transcending Physics and Chemistry, which you can find online, the scientific recognition that information in this sense lies at the root and heart of biology has formed the basis for increasingly sophisticated arguments against reductive explanations of life in terms of physical law and or chance, and for the need to incorporate an appeal to intelligence into any causally adequate explanation of organic life. So as Stephen Mayer argues in his signature book on this, would be Signature in the Cell, he argues there's simply too much information in the cell to be explained by chance alone. The information in DNA and RNA has also been shown to defy explanation by forces of chemical necessity. I mean, saying otherwise would be like saying a headline arose as the result of chemical attraction between ink and paper. DNA functions like a software program, and we know from experience that software comes from programmers. The arrangement of the parts in the DNA, it's a little bit like, you can make an analogy with fridge magnets. I showed you some fridge magnets earlier. You can explain why the fridge magnets stay on the fridge by appealing to the force of magnetism. But the arrangement of, say, you've got alphabet letters, fridge magnets, the sequence of the letters that are attached to the fridge, you can't explain in terms of the magnetic forces. And indeed, if you could, if the magnetic forces determined the sequence of the letters, well, then of course you could only ever communicate one message or one arrangement of those parts. The communicative function would at least be highly curtailed. The fact that it's an arrangement that specifies the protein order and folding to the function, etc., from out of the DNA arrangements as a code means that you can't give this kind of reductive explanation for it. Now, you may, alongside specified complexity, have heard of this term of irreducible complexity, which is a term coined by the American biologist Michael Behe in his book Darwin's Black Box. And he's talking about the way in which there are these little nano machines running the processes of life inside our cells, made up of lots of different proteins working together to achieve various functions together. So Behe says, by irreducibly complex, I mean a single system composed of several well-matched, kind of integrated, interacting parts that contribute to achieving a basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease achieving that function. For example, some bacteria have this little, what is clearly basically an outboard motor with a long tail-like propeller going through some bushings into a rotor engine in the bacteria, propels it along. And if you took away the propeller, well, it wouldn't propel along. If you took away the proteins that made the rotor engine, well, it wouldn't propel along. If you took away the connecting universal joint between the propeller, and it wouldn't work, so on. You need all the bits together for it to work. Now, Behe argues that an irreducibly complex system like this can't evolve directly by slight successive modifications, because before you've got all the bits, you're not achieving the function. Now, that doesn't rule out something evolving by some sort of indirect route, he notes. But an IC system is very unlikely to evolve indirectly, and as the complexity of an interacting system increases, the likelihood of such an indirect route of evolution drops. So if these IC systems are sufficiently complex, evolution by adaptationary, you know, little step changes gradually over time becomes a really implausible explanation. Indeed, it's really a specific kind of example of specified complexity. So we end up with an argument that goes something like this. One, specified complexity is a reliable indicator of intelligent design. For example, intelligence is the only known cause of such information. Two, biology contains examples of specified complexity. For example, in the large amounts of functional information at the origin of life, or in the origination of different animal body plans in things like the Cambrian explosion, when lots of major types of body plan of life forms came into existence in a geologically speaking narrow window of time, or in irreducibly complex biomolecular machines in our cells. From those two premises, it follows, three, therefore, biology contains a reliable indicator of intelligent design, and that the best explanation of life includes an appeal to intelligent design. It's not saying the physical causes of the physical world don't do anything, but it's saying they're not enough to explain all the data that we observe, and that the best explanation of what we observe will include an appeal to some kind of intelligent oversight, design in explaining what we see. Now, Dawkins says the complexity, and remember he's already kind of cashed out that he means by this basically what we mean by specified complexity. The specified complexity of the living body is so mind-shattering that the temptation to buckle at the knees and succumb to a non-explanation, by which he means something religious, is almost overwhelming, he admits. But humanity's best estimate of the probability of divine creation dropped steeply in 1859 when The Origin of Species was published. And it has declined steadily during the subsequent decades, as evolution consolidated itself from plausible theory in the 19th century to established fact today. Well, we may have already seen some question marks over that kind of statement. But if we come back to the argument that we're making, and what Dawkins' kind of design denial is a denial of this premise that biology contains specified complexity. And as with the fine-tuning, he would basically say, yeah, biology contains things that are functionally specified, but they're not complex enough. They're not unlikely enough to mean that an appeal to design is the best explanation. And that's because we've got this better, alternative, simpler explanation, Darwinian evolution. Note, Darwin's blind watchmaker hypothesis really is key here. So Dawkins argues, particularly in work like Climbing Mountain Probable, but in other places as well. So he argues that the larger the leap through genetic space, as it were, the lower the probability that the resulting change will be viable, let alone an improvement. Hence, evolution must, in general, be a gradual, incremental crawl through genetic space. It doesn't work in a series of leaps, because if your leaps are too fortuitous, that looks too much like design, yeah, which we're trying to explain away here. So Dawkins likens this kind of gradual approach to getting biological complexity to climbing, and he has this image of Mount Improbable, the cliff of improbable complexity on one side of Mount Improbable can't be conquered without design. It's this sheer cliff of stupendous complexity. But around the back side of Mount Improbable, supposedly, there is this series of individually and jointly, not too unlikely, selectable steps leading all the way to the summit. Now, Dawkins asserts, and I use the word advisedly, that although we've no idea what gradual, not too unlikely path organisms took up Mount Improbable, they must have done so. Quote, however daunting the sheer cliffs that the adaptive mountain first presents, graded ramps can be found the other side, and the peak eventually scaled by this natural Darwinist process. Well, how does Dawkins know that these graded ramps can be found without finding them? He says, without stirring from our chair, like in an ancient Greek thinker now, without stirring from our chair, we can see that it must be so, because nothing except gradual accumulation could, in principle, do the job. Question, what job? Answer, the job of explaining life without appealing to design. So he's begging the question here in favour of the Darwinist theory. Clearly, gradual accumulation is not the only possible explanation, which therefore must be true, because Dawkins is presenting the Darwinian blind watchmaker thesis as an alternative to design. So Dawkins is begging the question in favour of his evolutionary theory and against design on the basis of this assumed gradual route. Says there cannot have been intermediate stages that were not beneficial on this assumed pathway. There's got to be a series of advantages all the way, because you have to have something selectable. If you can't think of one, well, that's your problem, not natural selection's problem. Well, I suppose that is a sort of matter of faith on my part, since the theory is so coherent and so powerful. So in order to try and explain something with specified complexity or irreducible complexity as a kind of subset of that, like the bacterial flagellum there, we have in fact an appeal to no apparent gradual route, as Behe was pointing out. You might at best have a very unlikely circuitous route, but no indirect route. But the more unlikely your circuitous route becomes, the more that becomes plausible as an example of specified complexity. So here's a critique of Dawkins from a Nobel Prize-winning theoretical physicist called Brian Josephson. In a letter to the editor, he pointed out that in books such as The Blind Watchmaker, a crucial part of the argument concerns whether there exists a continuous path leading from the origins of life to man, each step of which is both favoured by natural selection and small enough to have happened by chance. It appears to be presented as a matter of logical necessity that such a path exists. But actually, there is no such logical necessity. Rather, commonly made assumptions in evolution require the existence of such a path. But we can question those assumptions and not beg the question in favour of a particular answer, rather than looking at what answer does the actual empirical data suggest. And indeed, concerning, of course, the origin of life able to undergo any material process of evolution, Dawkins' appeal to natural selection is simply a distraction. You can't evolve something capable of evolving in the first place. You have to have something capable of evolving before it can undergo a process, any process of evolving. But things that are capable of evolving by that kind of Darwinian process are not, as we said, little lumps of protoplasm. They are highly complex things involving information and irreducibly complex molecular machines and so on and so forth. As Bradley Montan says, Darwinian evolution only comes into play once life already exists. Darwinian evolution doesn't explain or even purport to explain how life came to arise in the first place. Thomas Nagel again says, the origin of life remains a mystery, an event to which no significant probability can be assigned on the basis of what we know of the laws of physics and chemistry. From a 2018 article by Steele et al. In Progress in Biophysics and Molecular Biology, talking about the cause of the Cambrian explosion, they say, the transformation of an ensemble of appropriately chosen biological monomers, i.e. amino acids, nucleotides, into a primitive living cell capable of further evolution appears to require overcoming an information hurdle of super astronomical proportions. What a great phrase. An event that could not have happened within the time frame of the Earth, except, we believe, as a miracle. All laboratory experiments attempting to simulate such an event have so far led to dismal failure. So here's the kind of way I would personally divide up the territory. I'd say we have this argument for intelligent design. We've got this criteria that seems reliable and some data that seems to pass it. And so there we have the idea that the best explanation of life includes an appeal to some kind of intelligence being involved in the process. And I would want to argue that it's entirely legitimate to call that doing science. But then I would say, if you want to move on from there, you're getting into the realms of philosophy, into metaphysics. If you want to get to the conclusion, for example, that therefore the best explanation of life is theistic, even in a general philosophical theism, well, you can't just make that leap. You need to add in another premise to get there. And that premise is going to have to be along these lines for the best explanation of premise three, that we have to include an appeal to some kind of intelligence in explaining the biological data. The best explanation of premise three is theistic. And you'd have to give reasons, arguments of why you think that is the case. For example, theism avoids problems that you can get into of infinite regress. So I suppose you could say, yes, absolutely, life on Earth is the product of intelligent design. It was the aliens from Alpha Centauri. Okay, maybe, could be true. But that does raise questions about what kind of thing are the aliens from Alpha Centauri, and wouldn't they be the kind of thing that does exhibit the same kind of specified complexity that requires a design explanation if they're material embodied creatures and who depend for their existence upon a pre-fine-tuned cosmos, and so on. So maybe we are the children of the Alpha Centauris, but don't they need... It's the kind of argument that Dawkins wanted to pose of the God explanation, but in this case, it would actually apply. We don't need to equivocate over our terms here. So we avoid all those kind of regress issues going straight to a theistic explanation. And of course, that explanation comports with other evidence, other arguments, like I mentioned earlier, the moral argument, or arguments from Christian revelation, or the ontological argument, or so forth. And if you can support that, then you can say, here's another example where what I think we can legitimately call a scientific hypothesis gives you reason to believe a premise in a philosophical argument for God. Just like with the Kalam argument and with the fine-tuning cosmic version of this kind of intelligent design argument. And put them all together, and you have a very powerful argument for some kind of non-physical intelligent creator of the universe who was also, to some degree, involved in life on Earth beyond just setting up the initial conditions and letting the laws of physics run. In some fashion. But again, if you want to specify which theism, you need an argument. If you want to specify which kind of theism, you need a further argument, and so on.